This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Risky business over the Baltic Sea. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Russian and NATO warplanes are engaging in dangerous maneuvers that are raising concerns about accidents and accelerated tension. We'll have examples.
Researchers are examining a coral reef in the South Pacific where the U.S. tested and dropped 23 atomic bombs.
You may have heard a list of places to visit this summer or things you need to do, but one travel expert has a list of things you should not do.
And getting away from the argument that it's best for everyone if your kid goes to college.
The sort of headline is the sense that everyone should go to college, that it's beneficial for everybody, is thrown into there's some disagreement when you look at the numbers.
Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin on why the rush to college might be a mistake. He's here in about 25 minutes. Well, NATO and Russian pilots are reviving a Cold War contest of nerves, increasing the risk that airborne close encounters could accidentally spark a conflict. Wall Street Journal security reporter Julian Barnes says the Baltic Sea has become the focal point for this new white-knuckle geopolitical tussle. He's based in Brussels. Julian thought this was just happening between the U.S. and Russia over Syria.
We've got some other hot spots around the world, and the latest one is over the Baltic Sea, where the NATO has built up its forces, and so has Russia.
So what kind of close encounters are we talking about?
Well, since 2014, we've seen an increase in these, and they mainly involve Russian jets, and they could be Russian jets intercepting American spy planes, American ships. But we've also recently had Polish F-16s intercept Russian plane carrying the Russian defense minister. So we have, you know, a lot more aircraft, a lot more ships in this region now, and we're having a lot more incidents where one side or the other scrambles its fighter planes to see who's flying.
Well, what does it mean to actually intercept? You come upon the plane and chase it out, or tell it to get out, or you just kind of flex your muscles nearby?
Well, look, there's a safe way to do this, and it happens all the time when one country, whether it's Russia near Kaliningrad or NATO near Estonia, says there's an unidentified plane, and they put up fighter planes to identify that plane, make radio contact, try to figure out what it's doing and where it's going. When it's unsafe is when you use it to make a point, and that fighter jet comes at a high rate of speed, maybe makes some dangerous maneuvers. And these are sometimes a pilot acting on its own, but other times it's a nation, particularly Russia, NATO says, sending a message to the other side, we don't want your planes near our territory.
Didn't you write one time in a story that the Russians sort of repeatedly ignore any type of communication during this type of thing?
That happens very frequently on the ones that are considered unsafe.
Yeah.
You'll have a ship or a reconnaissance plane radio to the Russians saying, trying to make contact. Sometimes they just ignore it. Other times they do make contact, but still they may come in and do a barrel roll over the other plane or a very close pass by. And the danger here is if somebody miscalculates and gets too close on either side and then there's a crash, all of a sudden you have an international incident, and that could spiral out of control very quickly if both sides are not careful.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal security reporter Julian Barnes. He's with us live this morning from his post in Brussels. So is this happening every day over the Baltic Sea?
Well, every day we're having intercepts, but we don't necessarily have an unsafe intercept every day. We had a spike back in June when the United States and NATO allies had some big exercises like ball tops, saber strike. And there were a lot of planes. The U.S. had its B-52s, its B-1s, even its stealth bombers in the region for a time. And so there was a lot of air traffic there. The danger here is Russia is going to do one of its largest exercises in years in the Baltic region in the fall, maybe as many as 100,000 troops. The Swedes are going to be hosting an exercise that a lot of NATO allies are going to participate at the same time in the Baltic Sea. So once again, we're going to have a lot of aircraft come the end of August and September right in this area. And the worry here is that we could have another spike in these sort of mid-air close encounters.
All right, so this is going to be the subject of talks.
That's right. The NATO and Russia are meeting. They're going to discuss that exercise that I just mentioned. NATO is pressing for details. We know that several allies are going to bring up this issue of air safety, too. Past NATO-Russia meetings have talked about air safety. It's not explicitly on the agenda here, but allies are going to raise it, especially in the context of this big exercise.
Thanks, Julian. Wall Street Journal security reporter Julian Barnes, who's based in Brussels. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, what not to do this summer.
You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Glad you're with us. With the busy summer travel season now in full swing, you probably expect the predictable how to travel this summer story. Well, not this year. If the surveys are to be believed, you're probably staying closer to home, spending a little less, but trying to do a little more. Consumer advocate and travel expert Chris Elliott has a slightly different approach. He's got a list of things you should definitely not do this summer. Chris, what you got?
Well, this is one of those summers when everyone is afraid to travel. I think you're hearing all about terrorism in Europe and the Middle East, and you're thinking, now maybe I'll just stay home and not take a vacation. You're also hearing about higher airfares. And I think that vacations are very necessary. I mentioned in this story, which appeared in USA Today, that there have been surveys done about how little vacation time Americans actually take. And so I think that you got to get out there and do it, even though the prices are a little higher and even though there are terrorism fears. You just have to do it.
Mm. So on a somewhat related note, you also say don't play it safe, get out. And these stats that jumped out at me here, 48% of Americans have only been to 10 or fewer states, and an estimated 25 million Americans have never seen the ocean. What are we doing here?
What are we doing here? Good question. Less than 20% of Americans have a passport. That's another one that I didn't include in that article.
Wow.
Yeah, what are we doing? Look, Americans are known for being adventurous and traveling, and yet there are so many of us who have never seen the ocean, who have never left our state, maybe even never left our county. And if you're listening to this and that's you, I would say get a passport, go somewhere exotic, and experience the world. The benefit of that is that travel just changes you. It gives you a bigger perspective on life. It helps you understand that there are different people out there that think differently than you do. It makes us more understanding. And I think that we could all use a little bit of that, especially at a time like now when there's so little understanding in Washington and so many reactionary policies.
Mm. You know, it's funny, you made me think of it. I haven't traveled nearly as much as you, but at least I've been out a little bit. And just the stories you can share with other people, to me, is just fascinating. The memories created, you know, it's so easy to document everything on your phone these days.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could sit down with you and take 3 hours of your time. I'm not going to do that. Just telling you stories from the road.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Right now, I am on an open-ended trip with my three kids. And, you know, we talked before we started this interview about where I am. I'm in Bend, Oregon, and we're traveling up to Washington. It's such a beautiful place. And if you never go anywhere, you're never going to experience something like this. I'm looking out my window right now. I'm staying at a place called the Tethero Golf Resort, and I'm looking at the snow-capped Cascade Mountains, and it is so beautiful. This is something you can't just watch on National Geographic Channel and think, oh yeah, that's now I've done it. You've got to actually see this for yourself. It's awesome.
Very good. Well, now you're showing off. We're speaking with Chris Elliott, consumer advocate, also author of a book called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. And he's written a piece called What Not to Do This Summer. All right, so by the same token, though, you also say don't try to do everything.
That's right. Well, look, one of the problems that people run into when they plan a vacation is they get a little bit too ambitious. And what I mean by that is they say, well, normally I would take a 7-day vacation. You know, I'd be gone for a week. But maybe I'll just do a long weekend and I'll try to squeeze everything that I normally would into that 3 days or that 4 days. And that is a problem, because then it's not a real vacation. It becomes more like a business trip.
Are you are you putting everything in? Let's say you're totally inspired by what you've heard from you today. Are you putting yourself or your trip in jeopardy by waiting until the last minute, or can you still pull that off given the apps and websites and things like that these days?
No, there are actually some apps that I mentioned in this story that, you know, again, they appeared in USA Today. You can also see it on my site in a couple of weeks, which is Elliott.org, 2 L's, 2 T's. But there are some great apps that can help you find last-minute deals. I also have a story upcoming in Travel and Leisure that actually mentions all of these great apps, so stay tuned for that. But yeah, look, the thing about summer vacations, any time there's high demand, is that a lot of hotels and airlines will set aside seats and rooms in anticipation of a high demand, and when that demand doesn't come through, there's this what's called distressed inventory, so you can find some great bargains at the last minute.
Thanks, Chris. Consumer advocate Chris Elliott. He, as he mentioned in the interview, on this open-ended trip with his kids, started, I want to say, late spring and ends, I want to say, early fall. He's covering something like 14,000 miles by car. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. You're aware of the push for more high school students to go to college, right? Experts cite data showing that college grads earn more money over their lifetime and enjoy better health. But a new Gallup report finds there's lots of tuition buyer's remorse. How about these stats? 36% would choose a different major. 28% would choose a different institution. 12% would pursue a different degree. Here's Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. Doug, set this up.
A really interesting survey that came out by the folks at Gallup that asked about 90,000 people about their educational decisions and what they regretted, what choices they wish they had made differently. And turns out that a lot of folks regret some of the decisions that they made when they decided to go to college or not go to college. And the sort of headline is the sense that everyone should go to college, that it's beneficial for everybody, is thrown into some disagreement when you look at the numbers.
Yeah, I was surprised, maybe not surprised, by one line in your story that said something along the lines of, you can't really afford to go to college anymore to go find yourself, like we used to say.
Yeah, so college has gotten expensive. The debt that people accrue on the way out is it changes behavior. It can be very hard. Many more people regret going to school if they have a significant debt, for obvious reasons. And what you study in school is a big determinant of how much regret you have when you get out of school. Folks who study the liberal arts, get a 4-year degree or a 2-year degree in the liberal arts, have the highest level of regret. Folks who study STEM have the least level. People who graduate and have more debt have wished they had done something different than folks who have lesser debt. So these are sort of intuitive findings, at least the latter ones are. But if you hit equals, what you start to wonder is, if you don't know what you want to study and you don't have a lot of money set aside for school, so you know you have to borrow for it, is going to school the right advice? Should guidance counselors be telling high school kids, go ahead anyway? And I think there's a shift happening now that says, no, think about it.
try to figure out what you want to do before you enter school. It's too expensive a proposition. It's too high risk a proposition to simply go because you hope that things will turn out well in the end. They may not.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. He's written a piece called Rush to College Might Be a Mistake. Explain the chat you had with Mike Rowe, the host of Dirty Jobs on TV.
You know, he's been a real champion of the skilled trades for a long time, and he makes some really valid points. Two I'll share, which are both in the story. The first is that there was a marketing campaign that started around the 70s that said, if you go to college, you're a winner, and if you don't go to college, you're a loser. It was pretty much that black and white. He talks about a poster he has from back then with a picture of a guy holding a college degree and a big smile, and a guy holding a wrench with a dirty face and a big frown. Mm. The idea is the skilled trades are not. There's no future in this. Go be smart. And you know, from the perspective of the United States, we need a lot of folks who can think and can work and have college degrees and are skilled workers. But we also need skilled laborers. And there's 5 million jobs right now that can't be filled because people don't have the skills that are needed. This is a problem for the larger economy. It's a problem for a lot of big companies, big corporations that are hunting for these folks to fill these jobs, and they're just not there. So, you know, the part of this is just the way people feel about getting a degree, that everyone should get them. That's been the message coming out of Washington, coming out of sort of the power structure in this country for a number of years.
Scary part of the story, too. You point out students who rush to college, incur debt, and drop out without a degree can be worse off than those who didn't go at all. How come?
If you do fail to graduate, but you take on debt, then you have to repay that debt, and you don't have that credential to leverage to get a better-paying job. You know, even if you do have a credential, if it's not in the, if you don't have the appropriate skills that the market is demanding, it may not help you that much anyway. But you know, generally speaking, with a college degree, you earn about $800,000 more over the course of your life over folks without a college degree. So there is a good return on investment that shouldn't get lost in this conversation. But if you go to school and don't finish, and don't, you won't get that return on investment.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Wall Street Journal higher education reporter Doug Belkin. Food for thought, 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend some time with us on this weekend. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. How to rise above your awful commute. Also, researchers examine the area in the South Pacific where the U.S. dropped atomic bombs. Plus, the end of the feature film and the stuttering major leaguer who wore a mic at the All-Star game to help others. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, as mass transit delays and complaints rise in several cities this summer, veteran commuters and other experts have tips for staying calm. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Have an awful commute? Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal is here with some tips on how to stay cool when tempers are running hot. Sue, what's going on with mass transit in a lot of our cities this summer?
Many cities are experiencing delays in their buses and trains, breakdowns, equipment problems, computer outages. And this affects people who, especially those who have no alternative to mass transit to get to work. There are a lot of those, especially younger workers, who prefer maybe not to own a car. It's causing a lot of stress for a lot of people in a half dozen major cities.
How can a bad commute affect the rest of your day?
Research shows that if you have a lot of stress before work and you have to exert a lot of self-control, such as not pushing back when someone crashes into you on the subway racing through the door or being shoved around yourself when you're in a gridlock crowd on a platform, that you'll have less energy, less mental energy later in the day to be productive. It's what scientists call willpower or self-control, and there are limited quantities of it, and it's important to conserve it if you can.
So one way to kind of deal with this is prepare to be delayed. How do you do that?
If you feel productive on your commute, you're going to be less stressed. Most people say that's true for them. So charge your devices, download work in case you lose connectivity. Plan ahead to take along a project that either will absorb your concentration, if you're that sort of person who can do that, or just help you get some minor mindless things done that are hanging over your head. If you feel productive during your commute, you'll emerge less stressed.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal. Sue, how do you prepare mentally for the day and kind of talk yourself out of getting worked up?
Well, it's important to treat other people with empathy and try to cooperate with them on the train. This will help keep your own emotions in check. You can listen to calming music. And before you get to the office, nearly everyone unanimously said, find a way to decompress. Don't get to your desk ready to lash out and vent. Try to get it off your chest. Take a walk. Engage in a calming ritual. Stop at your favorite coffee shop. And if you have a chance, walk through a park or even an atrium with plants, because nature works on us to restore our mental energy.
So is there a particular kind of person that is able to work through this kind of stress better than others? Do men and women handle it differently?
I don't think there are gender differences as much as there are work style differences. Some people are really able to dive in and focus and get into a flow state of mind more quickly than others. Sensitive people I interviewed for this story said the best they could do on a crowded train car was to put in earbuds and just try to listen to music or a meditation app or podcasts that engross them to take them away from the stressful surroundings.
And I would suppose even if it's not mass transit, you're talking about sitting in your car, it's the same kind of stress where you feel like you just don't have power over the situation, and that's what's so frustrating.
The lack of control makes the stress far more painful. Research tells us that. So to whatever extent you can control the part of your commute that you can have some influence over, that will really help ease stress.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. It's been more than 60 years since the U.S. dropped nearly two dozen atomic bombs on a small ring of sand and sea teeming with corals in the Pacific Ocean, about 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii. Now, scientists are trying to figure out why long-term radiation exposure from the nuclear tests on that area has not caused the marine invertebrates to develop cancer. It's a story from Doyle Rice at USA Today. Doyle, explain what's going on.
Yeah, a couple researchers from Stanford University have been kind of exploring around Bikini Atoll there in the South Pacific. It's actually been about 60 years since the U.S. used that as a nuclear test area, dropping about 23 atomic bombs, literally right on that little spit of land out there. And right now, the researchers are kind of determining what the effects of the radiation have been on the coral in the bay, and also some of the species on land as well. And they're finding it kind of a fascinating study there.
So the coral that should have been affected was not?
Yeah, these coral most of the coral that were destroyed by the bomb back in the 40s and 50s, but this is all new coral that has grown since then. And they were kind of puzzled as to why this area that has infested and been permeated with radiation, that the coral that doesn't show any signs of developing cancer. And it's kind of odd to think that coral can or might be expected to get cancer. They live very long and are susceptible to we had thought were susceptible to radiation, just like humans.
So what are the researchers hoping to do with this information?
Yeah, they're trying to kind of unlock what's going on inside the coral and see what's going on with their DNA to see what is it exactly that's preventing the coral from developing cancer, and perhaps that could be transferred over to humans, and seeing if there's a way they could figure out how humans could not get cancer when exposed to radiation. It's very early in the research. It actually hasn't been published in a peer-reviewed journal yet, but it's kind of preliminary research that they're doing. And so there are many, many more things to kind of uncover as we go forward.
We're speaking with Doyle Rice at USA Today. He's written a piece entitled, Can Coral Get Cancer? Research examines Bikini Atoll, where U.S. dropped 23 atomic bombs. What about the animals around the islands?
Yeah, they got a couple species there. There's a, one species of what they call the coconut crab, and it scuttles around and nibbles on the coconuts there on the island. And the coconuts, that, as far as they know, are possibly contaminated through radiation through the groundwater. So you'd think these coconuts are contaminated, yet the crabs seem to be happily eating away on them and show no signs of any disease. And that's kind of a mystery that they'll continue to unravel. And also, they did see a species of a nurse shark swimming around, and one of them had only one dorsal fin. Most or all nurse sharks are supposed to have two fins, and so that was kind of, they thought maybe that's a side effect, a example of radiation situation there. And they're still kind of researching it.
How dangerous is it for the researchers to be in a place like this?
Yeah, you can't live there. Nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live. Apparently, you can't drink anything or eat anything. Humans can't on the island, and so the very short-term exposure that the scientists might get, they felt is okay. But as far as actually, if anyone tried to repopulate or live there again, that's not something that they can do in the near or perhaps even distant future. I guess it's just best to stay away unless you're just taking a short visit there. But it is beautiful. If you ever look at the pictures of Bikini Atoll, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. And, you know, that all the A-bombs back in the day there, that kind of ruined it, but it's slowly making its way back.
Nice, Doyle Rice, right? Interesting story from USA Today. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Thanks for joining us. Traditional big screen movies have had a tremendous run over the past 120 years or so, and profoundly transformed global popular culture for the better. Although Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter Ben Fritz says the last decade or two have made it a close call. Nonetheless, he says 2017 is the year in which we need to admit feature films as a distinct segment of our popular culture have really ceased to exist. Ben, how do we even define them anymore?
Now, when we have, you know, feature films premiering on Netflix, you can't say a film is something intended to be seen in a movie theater anymore. That's certainly not true. Now that we have, you know, episodes of TV shows like Game of Thrones that are almost an hour and a half long and the budget's in the tens of millions of dollars, we can't say, you know, they're the biggest entertainment spectacles that last, you know, 90 minutes to 2 hours, because you get that on TV too. You know, you can't even say they're necessarily like stories that end, you know, that you sit down and end. You know, a TV show, obviously, stories continue. But if you look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, a show, movie like Spider-Man Homecoming, it really just kind of sets up a world, starts a story, and ends on a cliffhanger that's, you know, definitely meant to continue. So it's getting tougher to say what a movie is versus a TV show. All of our traditional definitions are kind of fading away, and the line between film and TV, I think, is really blurring.
So does Netflix get credit/blame for this?
They are definitely a big part of it, yeah. I mean, when Netflix is making movies and premiering them on its streaming service the same way they do a TV show, what's a season of a TV show, it's, you know, it gets tough to say what the difference is. You know, Netflix is really driving a lot of the discussion in Hollywood today, and this is an example of it.
I know a couple of commenters to your story said this is really represents lack of creativity in Hollywood these days. There's something to that or no?
I don't know. I mean, I think one could look at movies, you know, like Transformers 5 and Despicable Me 3 and sort of say, oh, well, you know, there's not a lot of creativity in Hollywood. But, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming got excellent reviews. The third Planet of the Apes movie opening this weekend got excellent reviews. And, you know, there's a renaissance of quality on television like we've never seen before in the history of American popular culture. And there's still lots of good, quote-unquote, movies, you know, even some of the ones Netflix is premiering. So, no, I would argue there's as much quality content, broadly speaking, as there ever was, along with plenty of, you know, kind of lame and uninspired sequels that a lot of adults don't like, but you know what, a lot of teenagers and a lot of young people in China and Russia love.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter Ben Fritz. He's written a piece entitled The End of the Feature Film. Somebody, another commenter to your story said when he thinks feature film, he thinks a certain level of investment and craft. Is that still around?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's no single episode of TV show that costs $175 million like Spider-Man, although there are seasons of TV shows, again, like your Game of Thrones or your American Gods on Stars, that are getting up there. So, I mean, some of the visual effects and the crafts you're seeing on TV, especially, you know, the biggest shows that are on Netflix or Amazon or HBO or FX or Showtime, I think they definitely approach what some of the movie studios are doing. And not to mention, you see some of the biggest movie stars and the biggest movie directors and the biggest movie screenwriters working in television now. These are the best talent in Hollywood.
Thanks, Ben. That's Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter Ben Fritz, who's based in Hollywood. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, so we'll finish with this. When Major League Baseball asked Houston Astros outfielder George Springer if he wanted to be mic'd up during the All-Star game, he quickly accepted. That might not seem like a difficult decision for most players, but it was significant for Springer. As Yahoo Sports tells it, Springer grew up with a fairly severe stutter and underwent years of speech therapy to manage it when he was younger. During Tuesday night's All-Star game, Springer spent the entire bottom of the third inning talking to the broadcast booth while he was playing left field.
Oh yeah, this is an experience of a lifetime. I'm extremely happy to be here, you know, just to be here with all these guys, especially all my teammates. It's been a lot of fun.
Since 2014, he's been a spokesman for Stuttering Association for the Young, or SAY. Springer's willingness to be himself has been a source of inspiration for his teammates, by the way, according to Richard Justice of MLB.com. Former Astros reliever Pat Neshek described Springer as, quote, probably the best teammate I've ever had. Springer was voted into the All-Star game as a starter for the American League by the fans. Achieving that honor is impressive, as Yahoo Sports says, but it was easily the second best thing Springer accomplished on Tuesday night. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.